Spring has sprung, buds are bursting, bulbs are getting ready to bloom, and a lot of us are getting excited about fresh produce from the garden. We should also take a moment or two to think about food safety. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. When it comes to produce fresh from the garden, food safety isn't something that most of us worry about. But today we'll find out about some precautions we should all be taking with Angela Shaw, Iowa State University Extension Food Safety Specialist, and ISU Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron will also be here to answer your questions about the things you'd like to grow or grow better. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. Spring is here in spite of the fact that a lot of Iowans saw snow last night, but it's going to melt fast if it's not already gone. And garden produce is not in the too distant future. Coming up in a few minutes, Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron will join us to answer your questions. But first, we're going to talk a little bit about food safety, which is not something a lot of us think about when we think about growing our own food in the garden. With me today is Angela Shaw, Iowa State University Extension Food Safety Specialist. Hello, Angela.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
It's wonderful to be online.
And, you know, a lot of us don't think about food safety when it comes to garden produce because growing your own food is healthy. Eating vegetables is healthy. So where should we start with these thoughts? We should actually take into consideration where our garden is, right?
Yes, the first thing is to consider where you place your garden. Thinking about things like soil, what was previously there? Was there heavy metal previously there? What was your house grown on? I mean, we have a lot of swamp lands as well as chemical landfills that are now communities. And so we have to really think about our soil and say, do we need a raised bed or is it okay to plant directly into our ground? As well as thinking about, if you're like my backyard, we have tons of rabbits and deer running through and we have dogs. So thinking about what might be going into our garden and can increase our food safety risk, even though we're supplying to our family or our neighbors.
So, for example, animal feces is what you're talking about there.
Yes,
okay.
Directly.
which can be a really serious problem if you have that happening in your garden. What do you have to do? What kind of research do you have to do to figure out if you can plant in the soil that is in your yard?
Well, this is both for making sure that you're growing healthy crops. So thinking about nutritional needs of the soil to grow, but also testing for things like heavy metals in your ground is one resource. And we have a lot of labs throughout, and Iowa State offers some soil testing as well that can help determine your risk of your soil. And if you're not sure of it, then a raised bed is your best option in bringing in soil that you know the source of.
Now, with community gardens or school gardens, is that an extra concern?
It is. And Iowa State has developed some wonderful free online training guides for food safety for school gardens, community gardens. And we just launched a farmer's market vendor and manager garden. And these are just free online that give you the basics of food safety considerations. But once again, we break it down in four different areas. It is the location or the soil, the water source you're using, the people, so making sure you're training your people, and then also thinking about your facilities. Where is the hand washing station? If somebody had to use the restroom, where are they going to go? So it's breaking down those four areas and thinking, no matter what type of garden or farm you have, how are you controlling food safety risks in those four areas?
What are the risks with water source?
Well, with water source, if you have a municipal water supply or you're using the city water supply, they're testing on a daily basis to ensure that that water is safe for us to consume. But if you're using a well water system, then it's your responsibility to do testing, as well as if you have a surface water, so surface water being a pond or something, you know, you need to be testing that as well. In the state of Iowa, we have a lot of water and catchment stations. So a lot of people using rain barrels. It's a wonderful concept, but just think about what's on your roof and what's landed on there. Salmonella, E. coli, you might be collecting all that water and you're putting it onto your fresh produce. So there are other ways to keep your water and recycle your water, but not on your fresh produce. It's not the best method because you could be contaminating your products. So really having a good understanding of your water and then having making sure it's safe.
So a lot of people, especially if they're in a relatively new subdivision, the topsoil may have been removed when their houses are built. And so they may not have particularly fertile soil in their yard. So a lot of people are doing a lot to make their soil more fertile, whether or not they're missing the topsoil. And so a lot of us compost or buy compost or get it from the city to try to make our soil more fertile. What do we need to think about when we're looking at garden inputs?
Well, just making sure it's from a good supplier. We have a lot of different brands out there that have some assurances upon them. And so buying compost, just asking if you're buying it from a store, then you know that they have some standards present. But if you're buying it from your neighbor that's composting, you know, making sure that they're checking temperatures and time when they're if they're rotating it or what have you, just to make sure that you're not getting a product that could be contaminated.
Now, a lot of us have backyard chickens, too. And so then we have other sources for garden inputs, chicken manure, that kind of thing. What do we need to think about if we want to try to make the soil more fertile that way?
Well, we're seeing a lot of chicken manure, fish manure. I think the sky's the limit. Once again, with that, you want to properly compost it. And so thinking about turning and keeping that 131 degrees Fahrenheit in mind and monitoring it is what's critical to ensure that everything that is present is destroyed. Because we know things like chickens, they carry salmonella, very prevalent in the feces. So we don't want to spread that onto our healthy, beautiful crops in the end.
All right. Now, what about how the produce is handled in the garden? And particularly with, I know we mentioned community gardens or school gardens earlier. So particularly if you have a number of people who are working in the garden, what kinds of things do we need to think about as far as handling the produce?
Well, it all starts with the people themselves. So making sure everybody is trained on knowing when can they or should they work in the garden or not. So if you're sick and you have diarrhea and you've been vomiting all night, just like schools, you should not be working in the garden because you're showing signs of having some type of gastrointestinal infection that can get onto our produce. So educating when you should go into the garden is number one. Secondly, having a good idea of personal hygiene. Everything from clothes to boots to hand washing. So if you have volunteers coming in, they might be coming from a livestock farm or other places that might have risk, and they're bringing that into your garden. So setting some standards of what do your volunteers need to wear? Do they have options to wash off their boots? Because they shouldn't be restricted if they're farmers and they have other crops out there to help in the garden. But we need to make sure that they have a way to clean their boots, clean off their overalls and things before they go in and work with the fresh produce. In addition to that, hand washing is a big thing. If they don't have a hand washing station available, then how are they going to wash their hands? So making sure that's available for all of your volunteers. And we see this with schools, you know, it's wonderful during the school week, but on the weekends, the school's closed. So what are their options? If they have to use a restroom, where do they go? And we all know if they don't have a place to go, they're going to find a place to go on the premises. So we want to eliminate that as much as possible.
How big a problem is this, really? I mean, I know you focus a lot on food safety, so you hear the horror stories, but how much of a risk is this, do you think, in the garden?
Well, I think that on the smaller scale, people don't think it's a big risk because we haven't seen as many outbreaks with, you know, smaller farms or what have you. But the risk level is still there, whether you're a large grower or a small grower. And it's been shown through both research as well as thinking about our outbreaks and lessons learned that it comes back to those four main factors. And so when we're thinking about producing a keeping local food as an importance within Iowa, we need to make sure that our produce does not get in the limelight for causing an outbreak.
Okay. And if you have questions about garden practices or concerns in your own garden, where do you turn?
There are a lot of resources out there, but we have a website at Iowa State called Safe Produce. And so if you just put in Safe Produce in Iowa State University, it will give you take you to a link that will be able to provide a lot of information. We also have a local foods page as well that talks about everything from food safety to I want to get my produce into the grocery store. What do I do? And we have a lot of workshops out there as well that we bring throughout the state that can provide food safety education. But no matter what state you're in, your extension and outreach specialists are there to help you navigate the food safety world.
Okay, so this is something that we should all spend at least a little bit of time thinking about. And we do have a lot of people who have a lot of questions this time of year because people are getting very active outside and working on their gardens. So I do want to open up the phones. The number to call is 866-780-9100. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With us today, Angela Shaw, Iowa State University Extension Food Safety Specialist. So if you have any questions for Angela, feel free to call us. Also, Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron is here. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here today. And I was so disappointed. All the magnolia blossoms are bursting. And then, of course, we had terrible winds and rain. The rain is good, but not great for the blossoms.
Typical for Iowa in the spring.
Right. We enjoyed them for about a day. So here's a question. This is from Cynthia in Anamosa. We have several nearly wild rose bushes that are about 6 years old. They're planted on a sloping bank in a sunny location. They did very well for the first 4 years, but don't look as good now. Last spring, they looked like they'd been hit very hard by the winter. We had to trim off a lot of dead stems, and they didn't come back to their normal size or vigor. Are there some steps we can take to help bring them back?
I would go out immediately and prune out any dead wood that's present. And then I would apply a all-purpose garden fertilizer, like a 10-10-10, maybe about a quarter cup per plant, and maybe fertilize again toward late May, early June, and possibly in July. And make sure they have water if we have a dry spring and summer.
All right. So that's a good advice for anybody with rose bushes,
yes,
I would think. All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back to answer more questions in a moment. The number to call, 866-780-9100. The phones will be busy, so call early and get your question in now. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email questions to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron and Angela Shaw, Iowa State University Extension Food Safety Specialist. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron and Iowa State University Extension Food Safety Specialist Angela Shaw. You can call with your questions at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Richard, we're always a little bit behind central Iowa. I'm over in eastern Iowa. And so are you seeing daffodils? Are you seeing tulips, that kind of thing already?
Daffodils, definitely. Especially if they're on the west side or south side. They're definitely blooming right now. Not tulips yet. Crocuses, yes. Siberian squill, yes. Forsythia, yes. Some of the early magnolias are blooming right now. So I would say we're maybe 6-7 days ahead of average. I don't say normal because we don't have normal weather, but
right, ever.
ever. So a few days ahead of average.
All right. And how about redbud trees? Are they starting?
Not yet. No. If you look at them very closely, you might see a little bit of color, but they're still pretty tight.
All right. And of course, yesterday's weather was a great reminder that expect the unexpected in Iowa.
Yes, right.
And now with an event like that, where we have temperatures dropping quite suddenly and we get snow, does that necessarily equate to a frost?
No, not necessarily. I think most areas that had the snow, the temperature was maybe in the low 30s. And so I think it melted pretty quickly. We had some snow on Ames last night, just a little bit. It was down to 34 degrees. Then this morning, it was actually 37 degrees. So it didn't really drop much after that. So.
All right. But of course, we're not past our frost danger.
Definitely not. No.
And I know that there are some early season things that we should be planting in the garden. Is time running out for anything, or are we pretty much still in the zone?
No, we're still in the zone as far as things like lettuce and spinach, radishes, onions, potatoes, so peas. We're still in that range. I would try to get that done probably in the next 10 days or so.
All right. And let's get to the phones. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Levi is on the line in Fort Dodge. Hi, Levi.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question?
I have two apple trees in the house I bought, and they make really small apples, and last year they were very tart. I don't know if the trees just need pruned to make full-size apples or if they're just crab apple trees.
Well, how big were they? Would you say?
The apples were probably close to a peach size, maybe.
Okay, so that's not really a crab apple. We say that if the apple is less than an inch in diameter, that's a crab apple. Bigger than an inch, it's an apple.
Okay.
They might be small because maybe the tree overproduced. So if the tree flowers heavily, if it sets a large number of fruit, you need to go out there within 30 days of bloom and physically, by hand, remove quite a bit of those fruit. So if you have a heavy crop, you may have to remove maybe half, maybe two-thirds by hand. If you don't, the plant has to put all its energy into all those fruit, and it can't really get very big in size because of that. So if you can, go out there within 30 days of bloom and physically remove some of the fruit. When you're done thinning, you should have an apple, one apple every 6 inches on a branch.
Okay, just
so
one apple.
Per 6 inches on the branch. So you might have to remove half or two-thirds of the fruit by hand. Now, the commercial growers, they use a chemical that does the thinning, but they do it too. They have to get that nice size apple.
Okay. Okay. Well, that's probably what I got, because they were bigger than an inch, but
okay.
They made a lot of apples, but they didn't taste very good.
Right. So make sure that you thin if they produce heavily, yes, and do it early.
All right, but not all apples actually do taste good. That's
well, now that's a personal preference too. So,
right.
So yeah, the taste does vary quite a bit.
All right, so it may not be an apple tree that you like, even if you can get the apples larger. But there's got to be something you can do with them. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Scott is up next in Des Moines. Hi, Scott.
Good morning, everyone.
Good. What's your question?
So I've got large trees. I'm in Des Moines, and it creates wonderful shade, but it also kills all the grass.
Mm-hmm.
So I've kind of given up on trying to plant a shade-worthy grass seed, but I'm interested in some other type of ground cover that I can use that will help control the erosion, but also isn't too invasive. The trees are, close to the neighbors, so I don't want something that's going to, create a headache for them. So I'm looking for ideas for good ground cover that, like I said, looks green and won't upset everybody.
Okay. Well, you could try something like wild ginger, which is native to Iowa. It's a native woodland plant. It makes a nice ground cover. You can buy it. It hugs the ground. It does spread. So that would be an option as far as a native plant. You might try to maybe make a woodland type environment where you put in things like, for example, wild columbine, woodland phlox, some of the native woodland plants, or As far as non-native plants, you could obviously plant hostas. A lot of hostas would make a nice ground cover. You could put in lungworts, creeping lily turf. All those are not native, but they're nice ground covers. They do spread, and I would say not invasively, but they do spread a little bit, so you could use those.
Okay, that's great. Thanks so much for the advice.
All right, Scott, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Here's a question from Karen in Iowa City. I moved into a new house last fall, and the previous owners had a lovely butterfly garden in the backyard. I'm not certain what was planted there besides coneflowers and black-eyed Susans, but there were a few bushy plants with purple flowers along with other flowers. They used garden fabric, soil, and mulched the area. So far, the garden appears to have no sign of life, and the bushy plants appear dry and brittle. Should I have seen some sign of life at this point? Should I think about planting things? What would you recommend?
You should see signs of life as far as the perennials. I wonder if the woody plant might be a butterfly bush. That is a woody plant, but in Iowa, it typically dies back to the ground each winter. So you might not see any sign of life at this point yet, but you should in the next couple of weeks.
All right. Should she trim out the garden debris at this point?
I would absolutely clean up that dead debris, yes. Get it out of there.
Okay, and by signs of life from the perennials, what should she look for so she knows what she should be seeing?
Green shoots near the ground.
Okay, so you'd have to look closely.
Right, right. But that should be quite visible at this point.
But if there's garden debris left over, maybe.
It's hiding it.
Yeah.
And as far as the butterfly bush, I would typically cut that back to within like 4 inches of the ground because typically it's going to winter kill anyway, so just cut it back.
All right, this is a question from Ken, and I don't know how to say what he's asking about, so I'll probably say it wrong. He says, do you know where I can find Chalone oblique or pink turtlehead? Does that sound
okay?
Chalone? It's C-H,
yeah,
okay.
Right, that's a genus name.
All right.
Turtlehead is the common name. It's easier to pronounce. The flowers supposedly look like a turtle's head, hence turtlehead.
Okay.
That's a common name.
He's in the Des Moines area, so he's wondering if you know where he could find it, or if he can, if you can't find that, can you suggest options for a native perennial in a shady, moist bed?
Native, you could plant Virginia bluebells. Now, they bloom in the spring early, and they die back. They're totally gone by the end of June, but in the spring, they're very pretty, so you could plant those. You could put in Solomon seal, false Solomon seal. You could put in Jack in the Pulpit. That does really nice in moist soils. But as far as the turtle's head, our turtle head, you can find that at some garden centers. It's not as common, let's say, as a peony, but you can find it in some garden centers. If you can't find it in a garden center, I would go online. For example, there are a number of good companies, like, for example, Bluestone Perennials is a very nice, reliable company, and they have a nice assortment of various perennials. So Bluestone Perennials would be an online site.
Okay, and you mentioned bluebells, for example. They do bloom really early. Is it too late to buy them this year, or can you still get them?
If they're in pots, you can still buy them at a garden center, absolutely. Typically, they will sell those as a bare root plant if you buy through the mail. But if you go to a garden center, they'll typically be in a pot.
Okay, all right. Let's go back to the phones. Next up, we have Jamie, who's on the road. Hi, Jamie.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Mine deals with poison ivy. We live by Sailorville Lake and by the Cherry Glen Recreation Area. And we have poison ivy everywhere, but we have one perennial garden where it just takes over, and my husband's highly allergic. And so after the poison ivy gets established, we can't even go in and get it out. I mean, I don't seem to have a reaction to it, but I hate to tempt the evil eye. So this year, we've tried to kill it several times. This year, we tried to kill it about 10 days ago. We sprayed everything. It killed everything. We thought, we'll just start over in this garden if we can get the poison ivy out. Do we need to apply again before we try to plant anything to make sure we've killed it?
Well,
given the rain and weather?
Yeah, as far as control options, basically they're digging the plants up is one option, or using a herbicide like Roundup. I'd be inclined to use Roundup. Now, Roundup is most effective when the plants are actively growing. when they're in full leaf. So probably at this point, it wasn't very effective. Now, you could wait until it leafs out, then use the Roundup. Or you might try, if you know exactly where the poison ivy is, maybe cutting the poison ivy off and then applying the Roundup directly to the cut surface. That exposed tissue will absorb it quite readily, but I don't think the actual twig will. But if you cut it and then apply it, then that should work. So those would be the two options, waiting until it leafs out, or maybe cutting off the stems and applying Roundup.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right, Jamie, thanks a lot for your call. You can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Next up, we've got Michael on the line in Coggin. Hi, Michael.
Hi there. I've got some Chester thornless blackberries that I planted last year, and I've got them on a kind of generic trellis of cattle panel, and they grew great, but how far do I prune them back, especially for the first year and then subsequent years, to get some good berries out of them?
What I would do is simply go out there and cut out the dead wood at this point. And the dead wood should be a different color, like a brown color typically. So it should be pretty obvious what's dead, and leave most of the rest. Now, you could maybe take out, if you have some really, really skinny, spindly canes, they're not going to produce much. Leave the bigger, fatter canes.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number. Let's go back to an email question. This is from Emily in Des Moines. I have a hillside in my backyard that we're going to have to landscape this spring. Right now, it's covered in tree sproutings, weeds, and lots of overgrowth. It's all starting to grow right now, and I'd like to kill everything now so we have an easier time digging up roots and clearing the hill. What is the best method? She says, we could use Roundup, but we have a dog that loves to rummage in everything. Should we use an herbicide and use snow fencing to keep the dog out? Is there a pet safe option?
I would say you could obviously dig it up. It's going to take more time, but you could just go out there and start and slowly go through the area, destroy everything, dig it up, destroy it. I've done it. It takes time, but you can do it. The other option would be to use the Roundup, but again, you need to wait until those plants are actively growing before you can really use it for it to be effective. And if you're going to use it, then you can obviously kind of fence it off.
Now, if it's a relatively smallish area, what about covering it with landscape cloth or something like that?
It would have to be something heavy duty, like a tarp or something that would keep out the light, maybe a big, huge piece of old carpeting or something that's heavy that would definitely keep out the light.
Okay, something that the dog can't drag away, too.
Yes, right.
All right, this is an email from Ellen in Fort Dodge. I never have any luck getting onions to grow beyond little green onions. What's the trick to growing big onions?
Well, you can plant onions from seed sets or plants. I typically plant the actual plants, and they're easy. Make sure that you plant them early in the spring, because if you plant them late, they're not going to form a nice big onion. So plant them early, like in April. And make sure the variety you plant is going to produce a big onion, because there are small ones and big ones. Make sure it's a big one. And if you do that, they should develop into a big onion.
All right. And let's go back to the phones. John is on the line in Beaverdale. Hi, John.
Hi. I've got a dozen different beautiful bearded irises in my yard. I picked them up from a lot of them are from Kelly Norris's place. Over the years, they seem to have sunken in a little bit. I may have planted them a little deep, and they've become kind of leaf and debris traps. I know the rhizomes like a little sunshine. I'm just wondering about lifting them up. I know the preferred time to divide them, replant them, is in late August or late summer. And just wondered if you had any opinions. Is it all right to get a fork under them and kind of lift them up and pack some dirt under there, or work some dirt underneath them?
Well, if I was going to try to do that, I would do it basically, I think, later on after bloom.
Okay.
I would hate to do that before bloom. I might damage them more than I realize, and therefore they may not bloom as well. So I'd be inclined to do it after blooming.
I can wait. Thanks again. I finally got rid of my creeping Charlie thanks to you guys.
Great.
great advice. I know you talk about it every year, it seems like. So thanks again.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, John. Creeping Charlie is a perennial issue.
Our favorite weed, yes.
Right. Absolutely. Okay. Mark is on the line next from West Des Moines. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
What's your question?
I had a bad case of tomato blight last year. Is there anything I should do to the ground or the soil before I plant this year?
Well, you really can't do anything to sterilize the soil per se. So rotation is your best bet, where you plant them in a different location. And ideally, where they haven't been grown for 3 years, ideally. Because the actual pathogens can survive in the soil on tiny bits of plant debris for 2 or 3 years. So that's your best option. If that's not possible, then plant them as far away as you can and make sure they're well spaced. They're not overcrowded when you plant them. And grow them in a cage where they're up off the ground. And the final thing is, at the very first sign of symptoms on the plant, use the fungicide.
All right, Mark, I hope things go better this season. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me today, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and Angela Shaw, Iowa State University Extension food safety specialist. You can call in with your questions at 866-780-9100, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.com. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and you can join the conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and Angela Shaw, Iowa State University Extension food safety specialist. And next up, we've got Lori on the line in Johnston. Hi, Lori.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, we live in a new development, and our yard is on clay, and there's no shade. And so it's also poorly graded, so there's water that sits in certain spots. I've tried for 6 years to do weed killer, fertilizer, plant grass seed, you know, a combination of all those at different times, and I'm just losing ground every year. And it's almost, I hate our yard. It's almost like weeds, and it's just terrible.
Okay. What I'd probably suggest is maybe having the lawn core aerified, where you pull out plugs of soil.
Yeah, I've done it kind of myself, where I've tried to like aerate it myself with like a pitchfork.
That's hard to do. You want to have it done by a really heavy duty aerifier that pulls out hopefully 3-inch cores of soil. So you get much better water penetration, things like that. And so do that. And if you have it done, or if you do it yourself, if you actually rent one of these machines, run over the yard, go over the yard 2 or 3 times in different directions. So make a lot of holes in your lawn. Okay. And then as soon as you're done with that, go ahead and put on a fertilizer, pre-emergent herbicide.
A combo of both together?
Together. You can buy those together. They're typically sold that way.
Okay.
And so that will prevent crabgrass seed from coming up and fertilize the lawn.
When should I put that combo fertilizer herbicide on?
I would try to get this all done in the next, I would say, 10 to 14 days.
Okay.
And then go ahead and keep the lawn well mowed, and then maybe aerate again in early to mid September. And after doing that, again, fertilize the yard again as soon as you're done doing that. We're basically trying to improve the growing conditions for the turf by aerating the lawn and also fertilizing the lawn. And
what
hopefully
about planting grass seed? Do I need to do any of that?
Well, if the lawn is really kind of thin, then what you could do is in early September, go ahead and core aerate the yard. And then as soon as you're done, go ahead and sow some grass seed. And then once you've done that, then drag the area with a drag mat or a piece of fencing. That basically breaks up the soil cores and works the seed into the soil.
What's it called? A drag it with a what?
Like a drag mat. There's such a thing as a drag mat, or just a piece of fencing, like a piece of chain link fencing with some weights on it.
Oh, okay.
Just something to break up the soil cores.
Okay. And then as far as, like, when I put the herbicide and the fertilizer on, should you do that after you plant grass seed or before you plant grass seed?
Now, if you put on a pre-emergent this spring, you cannot sow grass seed because the pre-emergent cannot recognize turf grass seed from weed seed. It kills all the seed. So you cannot use a pre-emergent in the spring and also sow grass seed. The best time to overseed is actually late summer. So I would do this in late September, aerate, sow your grass seed, drag the area. Do not use a herbicide in the fall either.
Okay. But maybe a fertilizer.
But a fertilizer would be fine.
After the grass seed.
Right.
Okay. Okay, thank you so much, Richard.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, Lori. The number to call, 866-780-9100. Here's a quick email question from Martha. I need to trim a redbud. Can I still do that? I want to take out two large branches.
Yes, but do it as soon as possible.
This weekend?
Yes.
All right.
Or early next week.
Okay. Mike is up next on the road. Hi, Mike.
Hey, good morning, Charity. Hello, Richard and Angela. How are you guys today?
Good.
Good.
What's your question?
You bet. My question is a point of contention between my sister and myself. I work in agriculture, so I've gotten pretty good at general field scouting and plant identification, or at least I consider myself okay. She had recently moved back to Iowa, and the house that she bought had a kind of an established garden, and she picked up where she left off years ago. And I was coming through, taking a look at her and giving her some pointers, and noticed that she had some eastern black nightshade growing, and I pointed it out to her and, you know, showed her the fruits and everything. And she's like, oh, that's what that is. Her neighbor had been coming by and harvesting that and then preparing dishes using eastern black nightshade, of which my sister also ate and suffered no ill effects. And I was borderline incredulous that this was a established practice, and I just wanted to get your take on the safety and logic behind that practice.
Well, if it indeed is eastern black nightshade, I consider that to be a poisonous plant. I'm not sure how poisonous it is as far as the toxicity, but I consider that to be a poisonous plant. Now, there are some other plants that may look like that somewhat, but that plant I consider to be poisonous. So,
and I agree. And I mean, I know that there might be some mitigating circumstance. I'm not sure if the toxicity kicks in once the fruiting bodies have kind of started to darken, and maybe they're, you know, maybe her neighbor, I believe she might be Eastern Indian. I don't know if they have different practices over there, but I don't know if she was harvesting it when the berries were still green before they went black and purple or what, but I advise her against it, and she is my sister and is stubborn. And
I would agree with you. I would advise against it. As far as the relative amounts that might be present in the foliage versus the fruit, I'm not sure on that, but I consider the entire plant to be poisonous myself.
Yes, the entire plant is. So it really doesn't matter the stage. It's advised against.
And it is something that you should know how to identify, right? I mean, there have been livestock losses because of it and things like that. It can be a very serious problem, don't want it around small children.
Right. It's a very common weed in Iowa, very common. It's native, so it's pretty common.
Okay. Mike, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, we've got Wayne on the line in Goodell. Hi, Wayne.
Yes.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I was wondering about putting lime on my garden, or should I put it over the whole garden, or just put some, like, tablespoons of lime and in my plants when I plant my tomatoes?
Oh, I would not use lime at all, actually. Lime is not a nutrient. It basically raises the soil pH. And in Iowa, our soil pH typically is just fine the way it is. We don't need to raise it. So the only time that I would actually add lime to the garden is if I've done a soil test and the test tells me I need to add some lime because it's too acidic. That is very, very unusual in Iowa. So I would not actually use the lime. It's not a nutrient.
What about on I get blossom end rot, not real bad, but I get it.
Right.
I'll be 10 or 15 tomatoes, and I always thought lime would help blossom end rot, but I guess it don't.
Well, blossom end rot is caused by a lack of calcium in the developing fruit. Now, normally we have plenty of calcium in the soil, but typically as the fruit are developing, and they develop over 40 to 45, 50 days, we tend to have periods where it's kind of dry, the soil, and then wet. And when you have those fluctuating moisture levels, the fruit is not getting enough calcium. So the best way to prevent the blossom end rot is when you have those dry periods, go ahead and water once a week to make sure the plants have an even moisture supply. That helps quite a bit. The other thing that you can do is avoid over-fertilizing as far as nitrogen, because nitrogen, if you have too much, also may contribute to blossom end rot. So those two things would help.
All right, Wayne, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, we've got Steve on the line in Clear Lake. Hi, Steve. Oh, we don't have Steve on the line in Clear Lake. Let's go to Mary in Center Point. Hi, Mary.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is, we just moved into a place this last fall that has several apple trees, and I'm really trying to steer clear of a lot of the pesticides. And I know with apple trees, everybody tells me I have to use pesticides or we're definitely going to have bugs. And I want to know if there's any alternative at all than using pesticides on my apple trees.
It's hard because there are a number of insect pests that attack the fruit. We have things like the apple maggot, the coddling moth, the plum curculio. So apples are kind of a high maintenance type crop. Mm-hmm. Typically, you do have to spray if you want a edible crop, basically. If you don't, oftentimes the fruit are not very edible or usable. As far as alternatives, I guess one alternative, there are some traps that you can buy at garden centers, sticky traps that basically attract the insect to them and kill them that way. And there are some maybe organic type products that you can use too. So that would be your option.
Right, and there are organic apple growers, so people have figured out a way, but usually organic apples are not as pretty to look at, but that doesn't mean that they're not tasty.
But they're usable. They're usable. And if you don't do anything at all, typically they're not usable.
Okay. So she needs to do some research on organic apple growing practices.
Right. Definitely look for some of the traps. They're widely sold. They're typically red in color. And you coat them with a sticky material. You hang them in the tree. That helps quite a bit. There are some that are kind of tent-shaped. You hang those in the tree also. And there are a few organic-type chemicals that can be used too.
Okay. I have heard some ramblings about how the Amish take care of their apples and that they hang buckets of things in the trees. And I'm curious if you would know what they would be putting in those buckets.
It's kind of an old gardening myth in Iowa to hang these jugs, and they put in various things like vinegar, molasses, whatever. And those materials at some point begin to ferment. And you go out there and you see all these dead insects in this material. Well, unfortunately, most of the insects in that material were not going to damage the fruit. You're not catching the right insect with those traps. So they're really not very effective. They look impressive when you see all the dead insects, but they're not catching the right insects.
All right. Mary, thank you so much for your call. There's so many things that we do just because we've always done them.
Yes, right.
All right. Emma is on the line next in Iowa City. Hi, Emma.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
I was just looking to get started in gardening, and I wanted to know some good like starter flowers that would be easy.
All right. Easy flowers to get started with.
Easy flowers, okay. Basically, I would say as far as annual plants, things like marigolds, zinnias, petunias, geraniums. As far as perennial-type plants, things like peonies, for example, daylilies, irises, very easy.
All right, Emma, good luck. John is on the line next in Waterloo. Hi, John.
Hi. I cut a couple limb branches that were hanging low in my mowing way. and on a pin oak tree, and I wondered if I should hit them with a lopping tool, and if I should put anything on those cut surfaces.
Okay, you did that when?
Just today.
Paint them with a house paint, latex house paint.
Okay. All right, I'll do that.
Okay,
all right.
And do it as soon as possible.
All right, I'll do that too.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, John. And if there are oak tree branches that are bothering you, try to wait, right?
Yes, because our main concern is oak wilt, which is spread by a small sap-feeding beetle, which may be out and about by now. So you don't want to do it if you can avoid it. But if for some reason you have to prune, let's say you have a storm and you have a major branch broken, you have to prune it off, use a house latex paint. Paint it immediately, should be fine.
All right. And now Steve is back on the line with us from Clear Lake. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Good morning.
Hi.
Two questions, please. Where should I go and how do I go about having a soil sample analyzed?
Okay. Well, you can have it done by Iowa State. It's a soil fertility test, fairly limited. If you go to the Iowa State University homepage, okay, there on the very top of the page in dark gray, charcoal gray, is the alphabet. Click on S. It brings up everything that begins with S. Scroll down and find the Soil and Plant Analysis Laboratory. Click on that. You can find a form and instructions on how to do it.
Okay, perfect.
And your second question quickly?
I lived in Austin, Texas for 40 years and had rosemary that grew in the garden and basically didn't have to do anything with it and used it for an herb and cooking all the time. Is there a way to get rosemary to survive through our winters here?
It has to be in a pot, and you have to bring it inside in the fall. And getting it to overwinter can be quite tricky in Iowa, but that's what you would have to do because it's not reliably hardy outdoors, no way, in Iowa.
All right, Steve, thanks a lot for your call. Mary's on the line next in Grimes. Hi, Mary.
Hi. So my question has to do with daffodils. I have some daffodils in front of the house on the south side. They've been there for about 3 or 4 years. And they don't appear to be blooming like they used to when I first planted them. Is there something I need to do?
Well, are they getting enough sun? Because they need
Yes.
Because they need at least 6 hours of sun to bloom well. Are you cutting
They're on the south side of the house, so they get sunshine all day. There's no tree blocking anything.
Okay. Are you cutting them back before they die back on their own?
No, I'm not cutting them until the leaves turn dead in the fall.
Okay, because those two things typically affect their vigor if they don't get enough sun or if you cut them back prematurely. I'm not sure why they would not be blooming if they have both those two things as far as enough sun and they die back naturally. I would just let them do their thing this year. And you might consider maybe moving them possibly. Maybe the soil may not be the best. And if you do that, I would dig them up as soon as they do die back and then replant them in a new location, making sure it's a good, well-drained, fertile soil.
All right. Thank you so much for your call. And unfortunately, we are out of time for today. We'll be back again with Horticulture Day next Friday. Richard Duran, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Duran. Angela Shaw, thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
Angela Shaw, Iowa State University Extension Food Safety Specialist. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, with production assistance from Julia Davis. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.